woman who's got to get out of town or got to leave the county for self-protection or for the protection of the children, she's got to go.
So how do you do it?
Well, if the man is telling her he's going to hunt her down and do physical harm to her, that's a crime, and even our busy district attorneys tend to respond to the idea that somebody's saying they're going to kill somebody.
Chair.
Yes, Member Counsel.
My experience with the district attorney's office is that they will much prefer that they will send back the enforcement of a restraining order to the county where the order is issued or where the abuse occurs. So the district attorneys can exercise their discretion, but they tend to shift the order back to a particular county from where it came from.
Mr. Chairman, see, I think the issue is whether you're going to, I'm assuming I'm going to try to get one filed, and I have moved to a shelter in Marion County, and I still live in Clackamas County, and my husband still lives in Clackamas County. I can, what this does make me go to Clackamas County for an hour and file the suit and come back to Marion County. I'm not sure that makes much difference to anything. As long as if you can file it and it ends up in Clackamas County with service and whatever else. Maybe that, I mean, that's as far as I'm concerned, that's correct. What's appropriate. Not, you know, so that I don't care that it ends up in Clackamas County, and probably it could or would, but I guess maybe I need to hear some practitioners to know.
There's a lot of reasons why people leave one county to file. They have family in another county, and not being able to file in the county where they are safest, it's essentially what you're looking at, is quite a hardship on those people, and that's really the policy reason for changing this statute.
One of the things that people that are involved in domestic violence have testified many times before is that once you get a restraining order on a abuser, and it's got a bail amount down there, and it says if you go out and do these things again, you're going to be in jail, but they almost always abide by those. And I guess that's I guess it's just a problem to me when we introduced this. I thought it was later than 77, but whenever we put this in, this wasn't brought up. And I think that this act is running into some heavy water of being abused by the people who are applying for them, men and women. The case I had, it was a man, I repeat, who went and got one of these things when he weighed 60 pounds more than the woman who was allegedly abusing him. And she was on welfare, or maybe she was just off welfare. I think she'd just gotten off welfare. She had to travel up to Washington County to fight this thing. I represent him. I'm glad to represent him. He pays my bill, and he's a nice guy and all that. But I just...
If I may...
I got problems with your getting more into this.
We understand that problems exist. It's respective of the coalition and other practitioners that... one of the real reasons that it exists is judges do not really inquire into any of the allegations in the domestic relation, in the abuse prevention order, and it's the kind of thing that Senator Cohn referred to the other day when I was here. It's not the act itself that is necessarily in any way inadequate. It's the fact that the processes which is being used to issue those orders is inadequate. And I believe strongly that their act could be improved in a way to make certain that judges inquire about those things and make certain that a man who weighs 60 pounds more than his wife and who is not in any real danger would not be able to obtain an act. And women who are not in real danger would not be able to obtain an act. But the problem is not with the act itself, and it really does do a substantial amount of good. And I think that that's undisputed also.
How would we, Mr. Chairman?
Go ahead.
How would we get the judge to read through the affidavit and inquire closely?
There was in the House bill, which has passed it's out of committee now. There wasn't originally a provision which stated that the judge should be required to record the hearing, the ex parte hearing also, and at which point you would have a record of whether they listened to it or not. Because I understand in some counties the judges never see the people. and that having that hearing might well, although there was some financial impact, and Bill Linden testified about that, that having that hearing would, in fact, make judges have to pay attention to the allegations. And we felt that that would go a long way to solving the problems of abuse of the act. We also made
one of the stories my brother wants to tell when I get on the stick and tell him that this bill is around, whether it's here or in the House, is that he wants to tell about the story where the man was out in the hall asking to see the judge to say, I understand my wife's coming in to do this, and I want to have an opportunity to be heard because these allegations aren't true. The court clerk, who thought she'd made the decision about how the case should go down, sent him down the hall, brought the wife in. They signed the order. The wife then went out to a shelter. They went out to serve the papers on the person at the shelter, who then said, no, I'm not that person. This isn't the wife, but the person who was running the shelter. I'm not that person. I don't know where she is. And they took the guy's, the man and the woman's stuff and got rid of it. And it just, it's a real problem. I don't know.
All right, well, I agree it's a problem. I don't know whether...
Well, I just think, Mr. Chairman, we have to... We come from different places.
It's it's a tough call.
How about a chance... I don't want to try and kill the bill in the lateness of the session, but since we aren't subject to that, how about a chance to get some people in to testify about the other side of it? We have had
but
one other...
Tell me how this could... Your courthouse case just then could have been changed by any of this.
Oh, well...
By this bill at all.
This bill, we'd have to amend this bill differently, but his suggestion that ex parte hearings have to be on the record would be a start rather than the clerk carrying the paper back into the judge and having the judge sign it in chambers without ever seeing either party, thereby granting custody based on a form that somebody's just gone down through and been told, check that box and you'll get the custody of your kids. And the
I just was trying to understand how this bill had any bearing on what your was this historian, I guess you're saying. You want to do a chance to do something different then, or improve the act, or make it work right, or do some more additions to it, or whatever.
Well, having supported it in the beginning, the way it has an effect is that I think it's gotten out of hand in some cases, and that to expand it, I think without addressing some of that would be a mistake. And maybe one of the ways to address it would be to amend this bill to say that hearings at which time these are granted have to be on the record. That might be one thing. Maybe we ought to look at changing the form. We all know that just telling somebody they have to swear before they sign something doesn't do much good. But it's all too easy to check the boxes now.
If I may...
Senator Hamby.
All I know is that the problem is significant. I don't think there has been an interim that I have not dealt with three or four of these cases. And I'm not practicing law, I realize that, but I act as an intervener all the time and trying to protect these women.
The bill in the House deals specifically with those issues that Senator Wires has raised, and I fully expect to get over to this side.
I thought you said that amendment was taken out.
That part is, but it certainly could be put back in. The coalition was in support of that amendment, I might add.
Well, I like to think that every bill that comes out of this committee is in perfect shape and it doesn't need any attention in the House, but of course that's not true. I'm to the point where if there's something that can be done, I can't put my finger on it right now, and I think we ought to get the thing out. So... I'm inclined to accept the motion to send it out.
Yeah, I'd move it, Mr. Chairman. Right. I think
Senator Cohn moves.
We can't sit here for that.
Moves 472 to the floor do pass. Any further discussion?
Well, just to say,
go ahead, Senator Wires.
You are now extending the reach of one of these forms you say you don't like, but. I'll just quietly vote no.
If
this consistency is not one of the virtues of this committee, anyway.
If we'd had this kind of a discussion earlier, I probably would have suggested that we amend the chapter to delete those forms. But here we are at this point in time. We can't do too much tinkering. We don't have time.
We don't have time to do it right.
No.
That's all right. It's all right. I'll just vote.
We'll find out if most of the people on the committee think it's right or not in a minute. Call the roll.
No.
Cohen?
Aye.
Hamby?
Aye.
Hill?
Dwyer? No.
Fry?
Aye. All right. Four, eight, two.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, this is the bill that deletes the sunset clause off the law that permits community health directors to direct a peace officer to arrest a dangerous mentally ill person. We heard the testimony in support of the bill without opposition. We have, since the hearing, gotten letters in support from the Oregon Alliance of Advocates for the Mentally Ill and Lane County Mental Health.
Okay. Any comments?
Mr.
All right.
Chair.
Senator Hamby moves Senate Bill 482 to the floor. Do pass. Discussion?
Somebody came to talk with me about this today and said they thought there was some way it could be amended to address a concern I expressed at the hearing, but there, I see Mr. Fultz. He's shaking his head somewhere.
Yeah.
Members of the committee, for the record, Gordon Fultz with the Committee of Mental Health Program Directors. This is not the bill Senator Wyers
is talking
about.
Okay.
It's 2158, which is coming up a little later.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
Excuse me. This is continued to district law, which has a sunset on it. You're concerned about that. May you do it
right. Right.
Any further discussion? Was this, you were the one who made the motion, weren't you, Senator Hamby? Yes. Senator Hamby's motion now. Call the roll, please.
Aye.
Brockman.
Aye.
Cohen. Hamby.
Aye.
Hill. Wired.
Aye.
Fry.
Aye. Now, let's see. I think I want to wait. Senator Cohen had to run down here on to a hearing. I don't know when she's going to come back, but she said a few minutes on this note here. I'm kind of inclined to take 9/11 and just kind of hold it for a minute until she gets back and go to House Bill 2086. And then the next one after that, House Bill 2158.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, there are two sets of amendments, or actually one set of amendments that make two types of changes. This is the bill that staggers the term served by the Corrections Industries Board. In your file, you should have Legislative Council HB 2086-1. Lines 1 through 15 of that amendment make technical changes to improve the language and readability of the bill. Line 16 through line 21 would give the board the authority to appoint the Prison Industries or Corrections Industries manager. At the time of the hearing, it was believed that this change had the support of the Corrections Division and the Governor's Office. Since the hearing, the committee's been informed that it does not have the support of the Governor or the Corrections Division, that the Governor would prefer that authority to remain where it is in the Corrections Division. So that's where we are on 2086. The remaining lines 22 through 25, again, are technical changes. So the major issue in terms of the amendment is line 16 through 21. And Mr. Cawley from Corrections Division Corrections Industries is here if you have any questions.
I have a question.
You have a question you want the witness to answer?
No, I think anyone can answer it for me. What are penitentiary industries?
Yeah, let's have
Laundry.
Come on up.
Furniture.
Yeah, come on up. We might have a couple other questions. They don't make license plates.
I was just going to say that.
State your name for the record and answer.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, I'm Dave Conley from the Corrections Division.
Did you hear Senator Brockman's question? He wants to know what the prison industries are. What are the prison?
Penitentiary industries.
Penitentiary industries.
Okay, our current penitentiary industries operates a laundry, which is currently being renovated, operates a furniture factory, operates an upholstery shop, operates a metal shop, and those are industries are located at the Oregon State Penitentiary. At the Oregon Women's Correctional Center, the industries program operates a customer relations a service operation, and that employs female inmates.
And a mattress factory, if I'm not mistaken.
The mattress factory, Mr. Chairman, Senator Brockman, the mattress factory was formerly located at the Women's Center. When the customer relations, customer service industry operation was established at the Women's Center, the mattress factory and mattress production was moved to the upholstery shop, the main industries program at the penitentiary.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Hammond.
I guess while we have you on the stand, what happened to the window panes, the windows at the women's manufacturer of the... Wasn't that...
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hanby, that particular industry never really did get off the ground. By the time all the equipment was purchased, the industries program didn't have the working capital to buy the materials to produce the windows. That's enough said. The
program kind of broke down.
Correct. I'll amend the proposed amendments with the deletion, Mr. Chair, of the line 16 through 21 of 2086-1.
16 through 21?
Isn't that the...
Is that what the...
Yeah, that's the language. That's the section that provides the major change in terms of...
Mr. Chair? Yes, Senator Warners.
Mr. Colley, who changed their mind here? You had your manager of penitentiary industries here along with the board members saying that he thought this was a great idea when we had the hearing. Now, counsel says the governor has changed his mind. I doubt very much that Neil Goldschmidt spent much time thinking about this.
Mr. Chair,
counsel,
and Senator Wires, I could help in answering that question. I think the impression came from a report that the executive department prepared while Governor Attia was still in office. That report recommended this change. So I don't believe that the governor took a formal position at the time of the hearing, but Mr. Colley can correct me if I'm wrong.
I didn't say the governor did. I said the director... The man who's sitting back there, who's the director of penitentiary industry, sat right there with two board members and said they all liked the idea. These are the people who are running it. Now, I'm curious about who has gotten into the act. It's obviously not Vic Attia, and it's probably not Neil Goldschmidt. But who has countermanded these people?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Wires... Counsel to the committee called the division and inquired regarding the position of the governor, the governor's office, on the issue of the recommendation that had been made by the exec department analyst. At that point in the process, the corrections division contacted the governor's office and inquired regarding their position on the issue. And at that point,
they called Corey Streisinger, you mean?
That's correct.
Because you're about to have a new director of corrections, I understand. Corey Streisinger doesn't think it's good. I hate to make an issue about it, but I thought that the people who were actually doing the work, who gave such a proud report about how well things are going, thought it was a great idea. They're the same people.
I'll withdraw my motion, Mr. Chair.
Well, I don't know how other people feel about it.
Well, I don't think it's going to do us much good to pass something that the governor's office has indicated it's not supportive of. So,
well, I doubt if the governor bothered to veto this small bill.
Well, I don't have any strong feelings about the thing, so I'm just going to go on.
As one of my constituents is on the board who was here, I'll tell my whole story since everything's got to happen so fast here. Not here today. I just hate to see it go 360 degrees when everybody seemed to be so united on this position during the hearing. Just because the lawyer, the governor, maybe if the governor's counsel would come and tell us, maybe there's some good reason. I mean, if there is, I don't have any vested interest.
It won't be the first bill that, you know, there's been a change in position on, as you know, in this committee this session. Let's just set this aside for the time being, because we don't have, I've got a bare quorum here now. And I think, let's see, I wonder if we can do something with 2158. This is the one. I don't know what we can do. This is the one, Senator Wires, that you were really concerned about, that you asked a while ago about. Thank you, Mr. Cullen.
Chair?
Yes, counsel.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you'll find in your files HB 2158-4, an amendment that I asked legislative counsel to prepare. You may recall that at the last hearing, Senator Yee testified and proposed two amendments. One amendment had to do with replacing the psychiatrists who could do the exams with examiners, which would include psychiatrists, psychologists, registered clinical social workers. The other had to do with who would pay for the exams. In speaking with the mental health division and community mental health program directors in discussing the problems raised by the committee, they felt that a compromised position that would address the problems would be to expand the examiners to include psychiatrists and psychologists, but to go no further. So that's what 2158-4 does. And I believe in Senator Yee's testimony, there was also a request for an amendment to have the courts rather than the counties pay for these exams. I think also in your file there should be a fiscal analysis which estimates the cost of the counties ranging between $100 to $200, offset by the reduction in the transportation costs that they would have had to pay in transporting the prisoner to Oregon State Hospital.
Well, I don't think that one has got too much changing the shifting the cost from the county to the state.
That's right.
I don't think I don't sense that that's got too much support in this committee. Am I wrong?
You're right with me.
I suppose the real question is whether -4 thing is sufficient to meet the concerns of Senator Wires and others, because instead of just everybody, it's going to have to be a psychologist or, well, it's not a psychiatrist, it's going to have to be a psychologist.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Wires.
The thing that I was talking briefly with Mr. Foltz and a man from Marion County today about was if there was some way to separate out the cases where people called allegedly dangerously mentally ill persons are going to just refuse to talk based perhaps on legal advice. It seems like there ought to be some way we could cut costs there. He has showed some interest in that, but it just came up today, so I don't know if there's ideas about language. He's making motions that he'd like to come and explain.
Okay, that's fine. Sure.
Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, Gordon Foltz with the Community Mental Health Program Directors and Gary Cass, Mental Health Division. I guess one of the concerns that we had was over in the eastern part of the state, we may not have psychiatrists or psychologists available. We wanted to add to the category anybody who's qualified as determined by the court. It would seem to us, Senator Wires, that in the condition where there may be folks who do not talk, that it may be ridiculous to hire a psychiatrist to come in here just to find that out. And the experience of Oregon State Hospital, I think, as Barry will suggest to you, has been that they have had a number of those circumstances. So that, as we would look at it, the court, under the amendments that you're proposing, would determine who was qualified and perhaps could evaluate to some extent the conditions of the person being evaluated as to what extent they would need the professional.
Go ahead, Senator Wires.
Well, I was reading part of the time when you were talking, but so is there some way we could change the language to do that?
Chairman, Senator Wires, what we've been looking at, not knowing the language that council has come up with, is a language that Senator Yee offered in dash 3. I guess our feeling was, and they've changed the term to examiner in dash 3, and determined by the court may be enough to do it, but to fully accomplish what you may be after, I think I don't know how a judge can determine whether or not there needs to be evaluation. If so, to what extent? But to bring a psychiatrist into somebody for whatever number of hours, only to find that they won't say anything, is a very expensive proposition and often eats up the service dollars that are available to counties. And that's our difficulty. And that's one of the reasons we're suggesting that it be expanded to include mental health professionals that are licensed by these folks. May not be a psychiatrist or psychologist, but they will certainly have qualifications, and there's training programs actually for these people. They may not.
I have real problems with that amendment.
Mr. Chair?
Counsel.
If I could ask either of the witnesses, could an examiner, mental health professional, administer an MMPI or certain other psychological exams?
Mr. Chairman, Kramer, my understanding is that these are not in the same categories where they have to have the MMPIs, that these are what's being determined here is the dangerous offender potential, not necessarily the mentally ill part of it.
Mr. Chairman, Cass. I believe if an MMPI was required, a licensed psychologist would be required to administer such an exam or any other psychological testing. As a practical matter, this is not always required in the evaluation of a dangerous offender, which is not the same as an allegedly mentally ill person.
The statute requires that the court find one or more of the following. The court can find the person suffering from a severe personality disorder and has committed a Class A felony, indicating a propensity toward criminal activity, or a felony that endangered the life of another and a severe personality a disorder. So in either case, the court has to find a severe personality disorder under the statute. And if the court makes those findings after the examination, the court can make a 30-year sentence rather than the maximum 20 years provided in a Class A felony.
Mr. Chairman, the diagnosis of a personality disorder is not contingent upon psychometric testing. There are circumstances under which other licensed or registered professionals do make such a diagnosis based upon the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual. And the criteria for those disorders are set forth with great clarity, and they're primarily descriptive in nature.
Let me ask the witnesses, from a perspective of the hearing, in which now the court has an examiner who is not a psychologist and not a psychiatrist, and the defendant being represented by a defense attorney, then proceeds to a rigorous cross-examination of the examiner. What's your education? What's your qualifications? You can't administer these exams. In fact, you didn't give this type of exam. Couldn't this exam also indicate or raise some light about this disorder? So my concern was the ability of the court to have the full information and the ability of a defense counsel to do an effective impeachment on a mental health professional granted the authority under this statute that they wouldn't be able to do with a psychologist or a psychiatrist.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Kramer, I guess from the standpoint of other areas where we have mental health professionals as certified by the division, I think in similar arenas, it would be a question of, I suspect you could say that the psychiatrist has certain training and psychologist, but these people are also trained who may not be in either one of those professional categories and certified by the division to have such training, and I would think that that would fall into the same category, that certification or licensing, whatever it may be.
Senator Brockman?
Sorry, what?
The chairman had to go out for a minute. He said for us to carry on while he was gone. What do you think of the idea of relieving them of having to send them to the mental hospital, but continuing to have them have to be examined by a psychologist or psychiatrist? Or are you convinced that a social worker is okay?
I'm not totally convinced of that at all.
Okay, well, what would you think then of saying do away with having to send them to the mental hospital to be evaluated?
Well, that's going to be a financial push if they're going to raise it $100.